You are listening to Let's Talk Tribe, the official Let's Go Tribe podcast.
Swung and lined to deep left field. It is gone! Hit well. Deep right. Batista's going to wave goodbye. Start the fireworks show.
This is Let's Talk Tribe, the official Let's Go Tribe podcast, episode 141. I'm your host, Matt Lyons, and in this week's episode, Manuel Clase is out 2 to 3 weeks. Somehow Mike Clevenger has already thrown the ball again. We'll look at the first modern failed attempt at making the shift. Opening day for the Indians still isn't sold out. We'll preview second base, and of course, we'll answer your questions. Joining me for all that and more is none other Mr. Merritt Rolfing. Merritt, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
The thing that we'll cut out right before this happened is that we figured out we've been saying Emmanuel Clase's
name
wrong.
What do you mean? I've always been saying his name right.
Yeah, I'm going to go back and edit all the previous episodes, and there'll be just an abrupt Clase every time we mention his name. Because
I was listening to a podcast today about journalism and the stupidity of being impartial or something like that. Great podcast. Citations needed if you want to listen to it. Anyway, they were talking a lot about how we live in the world of alternative truths, and I think that that's one of our alternative truths, is that either one, we were pronouncing it correctly in our world, or two, I actually was pronouncing it Clase this whole time, and I refuse to face criticism or the fact that I did actually pronounce it incorrectly at any time.
Well, the good thing is there's no possible way to double check that, so nobody can ever know.
Even
if
you do,
right,
that's probably just your own liberal bias showing through, Matt. That's what I learned to say from the media, so it's great. Yeah.
I think whoever finds something different just clearly edited our past episodes. We've been hacked.
You know what? I agree. This is what's happening, and we are not to blame for anything, really.
Never,
quite honestly.
But anyway, he is he's out 2 to 3 months. It sucks. It's basically the same injury Mike Clevenger had last season that kept him out for basically 2 to 3 months before he was able to be back into action. So
too strong. The typical
too strong
injury. Big muscles too big.
I mean, is this a lot of people have been asking now that every time there's injuries for the Indians, it's always like blamed on the medical staff or whatever. But is this a trend now, or is it just sort of random noise that we're making into a pattern because we're weird monkey humans?
I think the monkey human thing has some validity, yes. Only because, so Clevenger was making headlines prior to hurting his back about throwing incredibly hard, right? His velocity was up considerably. It was super cool. We were all happy about it. And you know what you use a lot of when you throw hard is your back, especially the area near your shoulder. I just think, honestly, this is not random noise. This is just a thing that's happened. I don't think the Indians particularly have a bad injury history. I think we just pay attention to them too much. But like last year, what was a big injury that happened? A freak injury to Corey Kluber?
And that was just a comebacker of his arm. So, yeah. I mean, that's nothing.
I honestly don't think the Indians, I think they're pretty good at the whole soft tissue injury thing. Like weird tendons or muscle pulls. They don't seem to lose guys for extended periods of time from whatever. You know, I mean, maybe I'm misremembering now, but
I mean, they have a lot of quote-unquote setbacks is what they have a lot of. But I think most of that is Terry Francona saying somebody's fine and then it coming out that he's not actually fine. And he's just mostly Tito talking sooner than the medical staff would like him to.
But yeah, that's fair. I mean, he's a chatty guy. He's a bit of a chatty Cathy. You know, he's a man of the people. He loves to talk to the reporters. So, but no, I think it's just we have a case here of a young man that throws 100 miles an hour. And that's hard to do, and not many people do it. In fact, he is one of like four, I think, they can probably consistently hit 100 miles an hour.
And so, if you remember, his 100 miles is different than other people's 100 mile per hour because it moves so damn much. Like,
yeah,
that was a big thing that everybody, I was starting to come around on the fact of being excited about Clase, even though it meant losing Kluber because of apparently how much action his fastball has. And it was super exciting to think about, but now he's not going to be here. So I guess the upside is that 2 to 3 months of a reliever is what? Not that many innings, so he can still have a huge impact.
Maybe, yeah, you know, yeah. Like that's the thing. One of those months is March, also. So whatever. I mean, yeah. So and he more than really any other pitcher on the Indian staff has a margin of error. So even if he comes back rusty, because again he throws incredibly hard. I did want to say just as a side note. So I saw a quote somewhere from it was on Twitter and some Rays pitcher. I think he was a Ray. He was a Ray or a Pirate. I don't know why I'm conflating those two. Anyway, this is all just half-remembered information. But he was excited because he said the balls felt different this year. And the seams were higher. And that the reason I'm saying that, and again, half-remembered, I tried to find the tweet again. I could not. But the reason this is troubling is because he just traded away a guy who lived off movement and location, and also won two Cy Youngs doing it. And now they're just going to be like, he's going to win a Cy Young in Texas is what's going to happen. And
we're going to be awful. Yeah, if Kluber can get ground balls again and not get everything lifted in the air, then
right, exactly. If he's actually getting, you know, big time movement and getting off the sweet part, anyway. I mean, it probably won't happen, but I remember I read that and it stuck in my brain, and I went, ah, fudge. And
even that first month of the season, if Kluber looks good in Texas and Class A is injured, and Delino DeShields is getting more at bats than he should, it's going to be terrible to be on Twitter.
Absolutely dreadful. Because, yeah, it'll be if yeah. I mean. The good news is Kluber always starts slow. Now, is that a cold weather problem? And the fact that he'll be pitching in Texas instead of...
Are they worse. What if he actually starts good for once?
Right, exactly. If he allows two earned runs all of April? You know what I mean? And his strikeout-to-walk ratio is like 106-2 or something like that. And you're like, what the hell's happening
here? I'm going to be insufferable. Yeah. I don't know about everybody else, but I'm going to be insufferable to listen to.
I won't be excited about it. I'll be happy for him because you got to, you know, you got to be happy for your boys. But yeah, no, bad news all around. So.
Yeah, but it's also sort of good news, I guess, that Mike Clevinger is throwing already. He had surgery on February 15th. So what, a little over 2 weeks. And the guy is already, or less than 2 weeks because the video was a few days ago, but he's throwing with a compression sleeve on his leg. He's throwing on flat ground already. I mean, I don't know what that actually means as far as his rehab, but. Good Lord, Clevinger. He wanted to beat that 6 to 8 week timetable they gave him, and it really seems like he might actually do it, which is good. Or is this another thing where they're going to rush him back and get hurt again? I don't know. I would think that Clevinger and the medical staff know better than just random people do, but
I mean,
there's a mix of emotions there.
Athletes are, you know, they play through pain and stuff like that. So you kind of hope he's not doing that. You'd prefer him to be, you know, closer to healthy. But the thing about, you know, a meniscus tear and things like that, it doesn't really heal necessarily. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I mean, it can take a year or more, but it's not a thing that blood flows into really, right? It's that cushiony thing. I know more about the meniscus than I should because I'm a big Dwayne Wade fan, and he hurt his in college and had a piece of it cut off and then later missed like a year because of more knee pain. And also it shortened his career considerably and made it so that he'd only won two championships instead of the three or four they probably should have. But that's a story for another day.
Didn't see what they said. Did Clevinger just get cut off or part of it? Well, what did they do with his? That's what I'm wondering.
With a surgery like that, there's two surgeries you can have with a meniscus tear. There is the long rehab one, at least for basketball players, where they like sew it up and it kind of, I don't know what the hell they do and put, and it kind of heals up again. And then the other one is they just cut off the torn part and then you're back good to go. And that's a much quicker thing. Like, that's a much quicker operation. That's the one that Wade
I would think they must have done that one, right? Because this was also just a partial tear, and then he's also back pitching already. And it's on his plant leg, too, so it's not like it's not going to affect him that much. This is the leg he lands on, and it's going to hurt like hell if it's not fixed. So, I don't know. I think it's definitely a year the Indians, like last year when it seemed like the Indians would win by double digits in the division, which they obviously didn't, it would have been more of just let him come back whenever. But, I mean, if you can get him back and he thinks he's healthy, you get him back as soon as you can because the wins at the beginning of the season count just as much as the ones later on. So as little time as you can have without Clevinger in the rotation, which also means less, I don't know, Jeffrey Rodriguez or Plutko, whoever is number five, then I think you'd do it. But I also think there's a span where the Indians are fine with only four pitchers, I think, right? Because that always seems to happen with scheduling and days off. So maybe he's got a little bit of time where he might not even miss more
inevitable rainouts and stuff like that too, like, you know, I'm sure there are,
and, you know, starting baseball in March.
It's a good idea, Matt. It's a good idea to start baseball in March on the shores of Lake Erie. It's totally normal and a good idea, and never once have they had a game snowed out and had to be played in Milwaukee. Just to pick a random place,
just random out of nowhere. And you know, they still sold that Milwaukee game out, somebody pointed out to me, like, even when it was snowed out, they had to go to a different place, the game still sold out. Mm-hmm. Unlike,
well, you know, opening day is a big deal, and it always sells out, man. I mean, you want to be at the park, and you want to enjoy the game, and really just see what the new squad looks like for that year. Especially now, with the Indians being so exciting, and keeping their core going, and bringing in big new talents.
I'm receiving some information, Merritt, that no, it's not sold out. It's been, by the time this week comes out, it'll be a week. I'm going to take a random shot in the dark and guess that between recording this and editing this, the Indians are not going to sell out, but they're in jeopardy of not selling out their 28th straight opening day, which I guess you can say the cold weather is a factor and the fact that the Indians aren't fun at all. I know you're making a joke a minute ago, but I guess they're fun, but they're not as exciting as they should be. And there's Paul Dolan saying saying that the Indians, his favorite fans, are the ones in the suites and not extending Lindor. So
are those all sold out? That's what we have to find out. Are the suites sold out?
Oh, I'm sure they are, because those are Paul Dolan's favorites. But you can still get plenty of seats up high for like $60, and then there's bowl seats for $200. So I don't know. Is this an indicative of anything, or just wait, it's got to be, right? Because before,
did you just say that they've sold out 28 straight?
They've sold out 27 straight. They're in jeopardy of not selling out. So
even when they were hideously, like, they were just like shit in the early parts of the of this decade. Because that's really been the worst stretch of baseball in Cleveland since they moved to Jacobs Field, Progressive Field, whatever. Then they were selling out. I mean,
because they were riding the momentum of at least like the '90s 455 thing. Because then at least you see them on opening day and never think about them again. But yeah, that's part of the bizarre explanation of that. It's just all the cold weather, but also 27 straight years. You don't just get to not selling out after that long without other factors, I don't think.
Right, exactly. Especially with a team that has good talent. I didn't realize it had been that long, but I mean, it could be any number of factors. There's the obvious Dolan factor of him just being tone deaf and stupid. There's the cold weather thing, which I don't know what weather's like in Cleveland right now, honestly. It's okay here, but I mean, I'm multiple miles south and by the water, so by the Atlantic Ocean, which actually I guess would be colder, maybe. But, you know, then I guess you could take into account other economic determiners, like, I don't know, maybe just wages have been flat in the Cleveland area for a while and people just can't afford it. I don't really know. I mean, if tickets are that cheap, then it can't be that big a deal. So,
and I think if you have a team hyped up enough, like, no matter what the other factors are, you find a way to sell out. Because like you said, even when they were shitty garbage, they still sold out. But now that
they're 2012, and like when the opening day starter was Fausto Carmona.
That had to be Masterson at that point, right?
Yeah, or like the year that was when Fausto Carmona was the opening day, or Masterson, or I think Jake Westbrook was the opening day starter one year.
Oh, yeah, he was. Yep.
Let's see. Cleveland metro area population.
But yeah, if you can sell through those and somehow you have Francisco Lindor, Jose Ramirez, this pitching staff, and still can't sell out, there's a very bad, I don't know what you call that. What is the word
Cleveland thinking of? Metro area has two
a bad PR look to not sell out again.
Yeah, bad vibe. You're of all the days you sell out, it's supposed to be that one. And yet, you know, they don't. And it's confusing to me. Yeah, so 2 million people and they can't find, what, 40,000 to go to a game on a, what is it, on a Thursday or something like that?
Yeah, which is another thing it could be, that people don't want to go on a Thursday. It's also that you can get tickets like 2 days later way cheaper. So
yeah, exactly.
I mean, it could just be like a perfect storm of things. But I really think like, if the Indians hadn't bungled PR the last 2 years so bad, they'd find a way to sell this out.
Well, PR, yes, but also, I mean, they bungled 29. That was a shit season. Like, in all honesty, that felt like a
what last year?
In terms of outcome, like, I enjoyed the heck out of it. Don't get me wrong, it was a good season of baseball, objectively speaking.
Yeah, but in terms of addressing what they needed the offseason following, it was
right exactly a bungled gosh darn heck. And if this is the best baseball Cleveland has seen since the 90s, this stretch, if not probably the best stretch since like Bob Feller was on the team in terms of consistency and talent across the diamond. You know, I mean, for all their great bats, the 90s team just couldn't hit very well. And they only really were great for a couple of years. The Indians were, I thought, had been great I guess 16, 17, 18. That's really it. 15 was fun. Or 14, they were. Yeah. Anyway.
14, they were bad. 15 was at least when there was a little bit of hope and Lindor debuted. And then 16 is when they start being really good.
Right, exactly. So I guess maybe I'm just, it just feels like longer than it actually is. But so I maybe I'm wrong there. But again, the fact that every day you get to see a Cy Young-caliber pitcher and then you get to see Lindor play and you get to, yeah, maybe they're just wasting what was a good thing and they're losing Cleveland as far as fan base goes and they're just trying to. And they just don't care. I don't know. I mean,
which almost sucks because then they can use that as a justification. Like, we can't sell that opening day. We can't sell tickets. We obviously can't afford Francisco Lindor. So it just feeds into their whole thing they're trying to build there of they just don't have the money to get him, even though you clearly probably do. But it sucks. Okay, and also, if they did sell out, then I mean, like, there's no winning for the fans because if they did sell it out and they sold a bunch, then they could say, like, we can still do well and not appease the fans as we probably
who cares
should.
Now these rubes will come no matter what, fools.
So the good news is we lose either way, so that's always fun.
It's good to lose.
Yeah,
wait, no, it's not.
And sort of speaking of that, the other thing we wanted to talk about is a really, I thought it was great. A post on MLB.com by Anthony Castro-Vince was about the basically the first failed attempt at the shift was Oberlin College. It was a terrible D3 school back. I guess they're apparently they've rebounded and they're a pretty decent school now. But back in the early 90s, they were just terrible. They often lost by like 20 runs and they were 1-14 by the time the story starts. But Jeff Whitey was the head coach and somebody by the name of Gene DiLorenzo, who was the assistant coach and also a basketball coach, came up with this wild idea, which was years before, obviously like 20 or so years before the shift became as popular as it did now. But they essentially invented the modern shift, which in a minute we'll talk about was actually invented. But their version of it was basically not based on any
this
numbers.
Is not a shift. I don't think this is. I think this is something completely different than what they did. Honestly, it's
yeah. Well, a shift is based on like actual numbers and trying to do something, but they were just trying to be freaking weird. They did something called the fly trap, which is the whole point of the post. Basically, what he did was they moved the third baseman and the first baseman out to the outfield. They moved the center fielder up like right behind second base. And my favorite part was that the whole point of this setup was to induce fly balls. You'd have so many people in the outfield, obviously. If you get a ball in the air, you're going to be good. So they wanted to have their pitchers throw Ephus pitches, which is just the pitch that you lob way up in the air and hope it like teardrops down into the strike zone. Of course, it didn't work. The whole situation was bad. They were still terrible. Opposing teams just bunted. Yeah, they just bunted their way on because there's nobody covering first or third. And then there was a bunch of stolen bases, so... but yeah, they tried it for a doubleheader. I think they tried it for like another few weekends after and then it disappeared. Nobody knows anything about it anymore, but it's a neat little look into an attempted sort of shift because the DiLorenzo also coached basketball. So his mindset was like in these other sports, you shift your defense around constantly instead of just leaving them mostly stationary like in baseball. But his idea was not exactly based on numbers or the modern shift, but he did something kind of neat and it was cool to read about it and just this very obscure college basically trying to shift and just doing it terribly.
I liked it because, again, like when we think of a shift, we think of just, you know, moving the shortstop over to the second base side of the whatever. And it is based on numbers. They mentioned in the article that Lou Boudreau did this to Ted Williams back in 1948 or 50 or something or whatever.
Yeah, that one's the actual like invention right. of the modern shift is what he did because he moved right. The center fielder was basically in right field and the right field is along the line. And yeah. It looks just like a modern shift.
Yeah, exactly. This is a complete... I've always kind of idly thought about things like this. Like, why are the players where they are? You know what I mean? Like, it just seems like it's happenstance that the shortstop stands where he is and the second baseman stands where he does and all this stuff. Obviously, covering the bases is important. But this is more than just a shift. This is a complete rethinking of how to play defense in baseball, which is almost impossible to do. But rethink that because you think about it, it's like, well, of course you need somebody to cover each base and then you got to have some guys in the outfield. But I've always thought the shortstop is a undervalued or underused freewheeling tool, I guess. The way they use it now with the modern shift, you know, you move him and you put him in shallow right field or whatever. But I don't know, do other weird shit with him, you know? I don't even know what it would be. Have him stand like near the batter and freak him out or something. I don't know. Or have
that's a good way to like get drilled in the face, though.
Well, you know, I'm just trying to think outside the box, just like these boys at Oberlin College did. Yeah. And it's just it's neat because it's like you said, it's they were trying to not take advantage of numbers that the other team is putting up rather, but paper over their own bad parts. And that whole so it's in a sense it's like using statistics because they're like, well, we can't do shit with ground balls. We are 0 for a million on that. So at least fly balls we can catch. And just the freewheelingness of this whole thing, too, where it's like they have this graphic that shows kind of where they are. There it's like three little trios and then the rover in the middle of the point man and the safety. They would move around a lot, too. And that's another thing. Like, we're going to get to a point where the shifts are going to be so drastic that, like, we'll have such minute numbers on people that there just won't be people and players in like large swaths of the field. Like they're already, we see that like when Joey Gallo is hitting, but like why even guess that he's going to not pull the ball? He always pulls the ball because it's what he does. So I don't know. I like this idea of rather than just a slow blend towards whatever we're going to get to this completely like, nah, fuck that. We're doing this defense now instead. And it's going to be weird. We're going to play guy. Like, I don't know, put your shortstop in foul territory or something like that. That way, you know, if you're playing in the in the Coliseum or something, then you every single one's an out. Or I don't know. I just think the shortstop is an undervalued tool that could be used in any other number of ways. And as athletic as players are becoming these days, or are now, as compared to even 10 or 15 years ago, I don't see why it couldn't be a much more creative use. Any manager that did it would be pilloried in the press because baseball hates change. But
I don't think with shifts anymore, really, do you?
Well, like, but if he did start doing really weird stuff with his shortstop, I guess. And to be fair,
if they have the numbers to prove it, I think they could back it up. But if they're just doing it like this guy was, just to like say, whatever, we're doing this now, then yeah, it gets shredded.
Well, if your team, if you're really that bad at catching ground balls, I mean, we've seen some real garbage off or defenses rolled out there every couple of years. Any time a team is tanking, their defense is probably hideous. I don't know why more managers, when they're captaining a ship headed for an iceberg, like the guy running the Orioles right now or whatever, just do something weird. I mean, you're going to get fired in 2 years anyway, once they start getting good. It's the way of the rebuild. Basically, the manager will get fired eventually.
It's kind of the same thing we're talking about the XFL. Like, you have nothing to lose. Just be weird about it.
Yeah,
there's
exactly.
There's no reason to be safe and do the normal thing. Who cares?
Yeah, if you're a real trash, if your team is just garbage and you're just getting this one chance, like, what if it works? Then all of a sudden you've changed baseball in some way or other. And if nothing else, you'll always have a job doing television because you were creative in doing something. So,
yeah. And I think the main flaw in, like, the thinking of the flytrap thing and comparing it to other sports is that, like, you can sort of funnel the offense into your defensive schemes, but like they tried with the Efis pitch, it's so much harder in baseball to influence what the. I mean, in the major leagues, you have so much more data. You can sort of induce more ground balls with a couple pitchers, but you can't like always feed people into your little fly trap. So,
I mean, I guess you could do things like pitchers are supposed to pitch into this shift too, theoretically. Have them. If you want them to pull the ball, you should throw the ball on the inside more. Unfortunately, it's also easier to hit there. Just because, I mean, chances are, probably numbers-wise, if it's closer to you, you're probably going to pull it. I think. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I did want to talk about these uniforms that they had, though.
Oh, they're great.
For any listeners who didn't read this, apparently Oberlin all had these massively old wool uniforms in 1994. Something they got out of Major League Baseball in the 50s, maybe? I don't even know. And I just can't figure out for the life of me why they couldn't scrape together a couple hundred bucks for not wool uniforms for these kids. Was it, I mean, this is a small liberal arts college in northern Ohio. I'm sure they had some rich benefactor who went there when he was a kid and still remembered the good days when with him and his chums out there on the old ball field. I have an assumption that any at all small liberal arts colleges have at least one very wealthy.
Every college does, I would think. Like, somebody's got to be successful, right?
Yeah. So some guy goes, hello there, chaps. a guy like that who says bully, and it's like 1994. It's like, who is this man? Yeah. But these uniforms were just apparently so hot. And why did they have them? And it was a high percentage. It was hotter than hole in hell, said one player. It was a high percentage of wool. We're talking really old school.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why they had these. It's great. And wool is a great fabric, natural.
Just maybe breathable. Not to play sports in outside.
Maybe you shouldn't be wearing them. Yeah, in the beautiful heat of a northern Ohio summer, beautiful yeah, and whole, humid.
Yeah, that whole thing was really cool, and it's the old uniforms. There was a picture that he posted. Somebody tweeted. I guess he was a player who tweeted Anthony Kastrowitz afterwards, and he put it in the article. And you can see like how old ass all these uniforms look, and like if you made it black and white and took away some goatees, it looks like a picture straight out of the 50s.
Those uniforms rule ass. I take it back. These are great. They should continue to wear these.
I mean, maybe the look, maybe not the wool, but
no, including the wool. The
everybody pit stains, sweats.
The everybody's pit stains the team's are a vital key. Yeah, keeps you fresh and keeps you keeps the blood flowing or something.
Yeah, there you go. I'll link that in the notes because it was a neat thing to read. It's one of the, I read this a little while ago. It's called Snowfall Journalism here. I don't know if you know that. It's like when you have all these fancy pictures and moving images called Snowfall, because there was a post, something about, what was it? I don't know, but it's really neat. There was about an avalanche several years ago, and then this guy just made a post that was a bunch of movies in the middle of the post, and that's that made all these new feature things, and that's what they all followed.
Interesting. I've never heard of this.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw it on Twitter forever ago, and then it was really fascinating to me. It's called if you look it up, Snowfall Journalism, it's the first actual news post that comes up, and it's really neat. But that's basically what this was. It was a big feature post, and it was neat art. So yeah, we can continue now with our...
In the failing New York Times, roasted. Yeah. Got him again. Got his ass.
On failing Let's Go Tribe, we're previewing every position on the Indians.
We are hemorrhaging viewers and also writers, apparently. It's great.
It's just me and you now crying in the corner.
Fantastic.
And just several puppets. We're going to the second base now. We're going... Naturally, around the old fly trap, Merritt. We went catcher, first base.
We went point and then safety, and now we're doing sweeper. No,
sweeper is a shortstop. What is that? Is that point? No, point's the pitcher.
Point is the pitcher.
We didn't mention in the talking about the fly traps that they renamed everybody for no fucking reason.
You gotta have different names, man. If you're doing everything differently, you can't call them a second base. You gotta call them a stud.
Oh, that's first baseman. Yeah. Rover is second baseman.
I guess it's Rover. Yeah. Right gapper, left guard, right guard. Those don't make sense. Stud does not, but I don't care. That's the best one.
So yeah, we're at second base now. We have Cesar Hernandez now. No more Jason Kipnis. He is, I believe, he's still in Chicago, trying to get on the roster there. But we have top 10 first baseman in baseball, Cesar Hernandez. The closest to baseball has made me more optimistic. But just like growing Emmanuel Clase growing on me, Cesar Hernandez, I'm slowly more optimistic. I think he's going to be better than Jason Kipnis would have been if he was still here. I think he can be an offensive bat and a pretty good defensive short second baseman. And I'm excited to see him and Lindor play together. I think that'll be cool. And then, I mean, between him, Lindor, and Ramirez, like from the middle left, the defense on the infield is going to be really good. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just overly excited for baseball now that even Cesar Hernandez is exciting to me. But if he can get double-digit walk rate and get his strikeouts down and be like an average bat, sure, okay. I would have rather had, I don't know, trade for anybody or sign Josh Donaldson and move Jose Ramirez over. But what they got, it could be worse. It could be Mike Freeman, who is on the 40-man roster, but they decided to get an actual second baseman, so that's fun. But
I will not have you besmirch him. He's my favorite player.
We'll get to your favorite player in a minute, but what are your thoughts on newest second baseman?
I mean, you'll get some of the numbers, and he does all the things well that Kipnis never really did, specifically defend. He's a good glove, doesn't hit the ball very hard. He's a very classic second baseman you kind of forget about kind of a guy, because he's, you know, you look at him, he's not going to make any mistakes really, defensively. He unaccountably was like top 10 in the top 10% of the league in walk rate in 2018, which just, I don't know, that's weird, but that's fun little blips. And then dropped right down from 13.4 to 6.7 last year.
He's walked quite a few years in a row, at least, like from 2016 to 2018, and then
I mean, we're not hoping for anything huge here. But like a walk rate between 8 and 10%. He's got good speed, so you can hope at the very least, if he's not stealing bases, he's going first to third on things and defending well, getting on base at a, what did he do last year? 333 clip career, it's 352 is his on base percentage, which would be great. That would be one of, honestly, if he was like at 340, it would be one of the better ones on the team.
Yeah, and that's what his bad walk rate. So if he can up that a little more, then maybe his on-base percentage goes up.
And this guy's going to be batting, what, 7th, 8th, 9th, probably? He's going to be one of the softer bats on the team, but it's very evident that he's not there for the impact that his bat is going to have, which, as you mentioned, is not going to be negative. I think he'll produce somewhere around, I mean, it's not good, but these are the things that we look forward to sometimes. Like a 90 to 100 WRC plus somewhere, if we're being optimistic and his walk rate does go up, then maybe he could be right around 100, and that'd be nice. Just so he's not pulling anything out of the offense. He's at least a net neutral there, and then adding something with his glove, making Lindor's life a little bit easier, making whoever the first baseman's life a little bit easier, everyone, you know, and then allowing, obviously, Ramirez to settle in at third. If nothing else, it's a settling influence that, just defensively, as much as we always love Jason Kipnis, he was a practiced glove, and he got good late in his Indians career at pre-pitch positioning. But
he would not be what you call settling on defense.
No,
he's the opposite of a settling presence.
Right, his life was made possibly easier by the existence of Lindor, and I mean the fact that if Hernandez does produce like he has the last couple years, if you look at his outs above average, he's in the 84th percentile. Which is good, obviously. So no, I think the Indians will be able to, at the very least, boast a very solid defense. And we talked about this with Roberto Perez, but with the young guys that are going to be, they're running through the rotation now, like with Savali and Plezak and Jeffrey Rodriguez, if he does end up making a couple starts. Again, this is a settling influence for them as well, because they don't have to miss every single bat. They can give up a grounder to the left side or the right side or wherever. And there's three guys out there who, if not gold glove caliber, are at least, you know, top
good glove caliber.
Top 10 or 15% of the league. And that's fine. And that works. You know, it's something to not worry about. And for a team that's kind of on the precipice in so many different ways, that's nice.
Now, behind Hernandez, if anything happens to him or he doesn't start 160 games like he has last two seasons, it is a forest fire. It's Christian Arroyo, who was a very, very post hype prospect. He was, what was it with the Rays? He was initially hyped, and then he was traded to the Giants when he was bad in the majors. Then he was injured, but he comes over. He's just basically trying to prove himself. He's a potential backup utility guy. Also, there's Yu Chang, who was also basically in the same boat, but was never quite hyped as much. But he's also kind of lost a ton of his value and potential.
Why did I hype him up in my head so much? Why was I so excited for Yu Chang?
Prospects are fun, but I don't know. He did have some hope a little bit there for a little bit. And then when he got to the majors, it was very clear, like, it's not there. It's sorry, Chang. I'm really excited for you. But yeah, there was a couple of years in like the lower levels. And when he got to AAA, he was a pretty average bat, and his defense was fine. He hit 20 home runs one season. That was the biggest thing for Chang. But yeah, behind Cesar Hernandez, it drops off quite sharply. I mean, Mike Freeman's another option, which is not a good one because he's terrible. But yeah, as far as depth at the second base, I don't think you need a whole lot of depth there, because as long as he's not injured, like, Hernandez has played 161 games the last 2 years. So it's not really a matter of like catcher where you need to swap guys in and out. But if Hernandez can keep playing, who cares? But if he can't, oh no, it's going to be bad.
What is with the Indians in second baseman? I mean, prior to Jason Kipnis, who was the best second baseman that they drafted and developed? Can you think of who it would be? I mean, I don't want to go all back to like Nap Lajoie, but you never know. And sometimes it ends up that way.
I don't know, because I mean, obviously they didn't draft Roberto Alomar, and he's the last really good one.
Yeah, exactly. Because before him, it was, I don't even know who would be then. Sorry,
I'm just trying to jog my memory, and I'm definitely not going to look up on FanGraphs. I'm just talking, Merritt.
I am not literally operating the Baseball References Play Index right now.
I'm just clicking away. Did they draft somebody named Joe Gordon? They didn't draft Carlos Baerga, did they?
Carlos Baerga. Well, they did draft Carlos Baerga, but I mean, okay, so I guess Carlos Baerga. Yeah.
I mean, going strictly by WAR, this is all off the top of my head, not on FanGraphs or anything, but Joe Gordon was probably the last. Let me see if they drafted him. In 1948, 1947. Let me think back into my head if they drafted him. No, he was with the Yankees. That doesn't count.
Ah, shit, I'm not signed in. Or I haven't paid them. Oh, okay, damn.
No, it's Baerga and then a bunch of nothing. They don't draft second baseman, apparently. I'm trying to look.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I guess you can count Ramirez. He played second base. He was good that fair. 1 year at second.
That's fair. And this is not to like belittle Kipnis. Andy Kipnis was a wonderful surprise. I mean, a second round pick to have that long of a career with one team that was impactful for several of them.
Yeah. And it's not a knock on Kipnis, it's a knock on the Indians and their second baseman before him.
Well, what was the last time a good second baseman was drafted in the first round? Who's the best second baseman in baseball? Oh, yeah, we had this conversation already when they picked up Cesar Hernandez, because just in general, second base is a dumpster fire in Major League Baseball.
Yeah. I think the last like really great, great second baseman was Robinson Cano before he was busted.
Yeah, Cano, and before that was maybe Chase Utley? I don't even know.
Definitely Chase Utley, yeah.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Did they draft?
Ketel Marte, I guess? DJ LeMahieu, Max Muncy, second
base. I guess DJ you still have to see if LeMahieu was a 1 year kind of thing, but right. If he does that again, he's obviously up there.
Yeah, he's number one. I mean, Ketel Marte was a 7-win player last year. Jesus Christ, was he really? Oof. And you should trade for him. So, but back to the Indians' own defense and off whatever on second base. I can't talk tonight, which is great on a talking medium. I don't know. I was excited for Yu Chang, and it doesn't seem to have panned out. He walked okay when he was on the Indians, 13.4% walk rate. But beyond that, it's, yeah, like you said, a bit of a dumpster fire.
Tiny bit, yeah. But yeah, so what would you give this grade of top 10 Cesar Hernandez and dumpster fire behind him? What grade would you give it? F to A kind of thing.
Remind me again, is this based off everything else on the Indians or
No, no, we've established. If it was based on everything else on the Indians, it'd be an A because you have to compare it to the outfield. This is based on second base within the league.
I mean, we've talked about it before. I mean, I'll give it a C. You know, again, I'm not excited, but or C plus. No, you know, I'll give it a B minus, an irritating score, because I'm like, oh, you got an 80 out of 100, you bitch.
Yeah, I can't
the kind of thing you, yeah, the grade you give to a very good but annoying student, the minus. So no, I'll give it like a C plus, B minus kind of a thing, because again, Hernandez should be fine, and I think we'll complain about him more than is apt, only because he'll be bad offensively. But again, he'll be batting like eighth, and so as long as he's not just murdering rallies, as long as he's not just absolutely just crippling the ability to sustain offense in a single inning constantly, as long as that's not happening, and he's, you know, again, if he can get his walk rate up a little bit and things like that, then great, I'm all for him. And then just let's not worry about anything after that, because
let's just hope that we keep our stud and he doesn't get injured. No, not stud, the roamer, whatever.
Isn't this a stud?
No, stud's first. We just established.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the positioning, the stud is standing where the second baseman typically sort of stands.
The rover, that's the second baseman. Yeah. We just got to hope to God he doesn't get injured, because it can get a lot. We'll discover real quickly that didn't get worse than Cesar Hernandez. So.
I mean, maybe Christian Arroyo is good, actually. Nope. Now, maybe he'll figure it out. He did.
Maybe he's a chip on the shoulder kind of guy where he has to have everybody against
him. 304 in high A, and then he hit 396 in the PCL, which is definitely not a hitter's league. Let me just reiterate this one more time. Not a hitter's league.
So yeah, my grades, I can't go above a C. Cesar Hernandez is going to be, like you said, he's going to be fine, but I'm not going to give him a B for fine. C, you passed, but
well, tell your parents. Again, if he's as good defensively as the stats suggest, then that's great. And that's what I'm looking for here, is just something that I don't complain about, because I'm going to have too much time complaining about things like Jake Bowers. I don't even know what I'm complaining about, but I want him to be good so bad, and he won't be good. And just...
somebody pointed out today that he's Casey Jotar of Cleveland Baseball Insider. He pointed out that Jake Bowers has swung at like the first pitch of every at bat in spring training, so he hasn't had like a single count besides one pitch. He's either been out or got a hit, and then he struck out three straight pitches in one at bat. So
awesome!
He's having quite the spring over there. He's having a normal one, but
he's just aggression. You know, he's like, you know what? I'm going to be like Derek Jeter. I'm going to swing the first pitch every time.
I mean, Mary, you can't watch a 1-2 called strike if you don't get to a 1-2 count. So he's just...
I don't even remind me of those things. I forgot about that until just now. Oh, my God. Oh, right out of the corner. You suck.
That's how
oh.
he's fixing himself. Yeah. Yeah. So we'll wrap it up with we'll ask questions. Every Sunday, we ask you guys for questions on Twitter and Facebook. This week, we've got a couple good ones. We had a couple for, I think we mentioned at NOP48DH. He asked if Clevenger will have an injury-free season. That sort of goes off a little bit different than what we talked about, but like, I don't know, maybe is he injury prone at this point, or because these are at least not the same injury, but it's not like getting hit with a ball or something freak. It's still his body is reacting to whatever the hell he's doing. So I'm kind of worried he might just be an injury prone pitcher at this point.
What have we had so far? We had the shoulder and we have the knee. Was there anything else?
I mean, Tommy John forever many years ago. So
whatever that happens. I mean, that's just a rite of passage.
Yeah.
Well,
so, I mean, he has had a couple at this point. He hasn't had a full.
Injuries that are happening to him are, at least in my estimation, are from trying to throw too hard, the back upper back thing, and succeeding, but his body just rebelling at first before it got used to it. And then this could also be a result of the same thing. So maybe, I mean, I'm not going to say he's injury prone. Players can be labeled injury prone and then just all of a sudden have a 10-year run where they're not injured ever.
That's true.
So it does seem like these are in a way related, because you tear your meniscus with repeated coming down hard on it over and over and over, right? That's kind of how that happens, I'm pretty sure.
I would think. Do you come down harder on your leg when you're throwing harder? That might be a dumb question, but
well, I mean,
I would assume there's got to be more force, right?
Yeah, you throw with your butt, so
naturally
you're driving off the, you know, you drive off the, what do you call it, the rubber, and you probably do come down harder. Yeah, I'd think so. So maybe, I don't know about injury prone, but this could just be another symptom of his pushing himself to a next level he's trying to achieve, which is great for the Indians in a way, because he's turning into an ace. But
yeah, I mean, you can get him like an ace level for maybe not a full season, just about every year. I think you take that over like a four or five year A, and then Buddy's also pitches every game. Like I think,
right? Because like if you look at the pitcher he was in 2016, which is his first year.
Yeah, that was before his velocity spiked, and he was right. He was mostly reliever than anything too. But
when he threw 100 and. Well, even then, I mean, 2017, he was really good, but his velocity started going up in 2018, right?
So, yeah, that's when he took off, is really good.
Yeah, 2018. I mean, I don't know. He's thrown 100, if he can get 100, and the hope is 150 to 200 innings a year, I guess. I mean, it'd be nice if he could do the 200 like he did in 2018 when he really emerged, but if not, who cares? Like 165 or so innings of elite pitching is better than most teams can hope for, you know? So,
so next we have a couple of... Well, thank you for that question, first of all.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Yeah, that's a good one. So our next, we got a pair of Bobby Bradley questions. What? Everybody loves Bobby Bradley questions. And of course, these are asked because he obliterated another baseball today. But the first one from at I Am Harad, he asks if Bobby Bradley continues to not strike out the spring as he makes the big league club. And sort of related, I mean, at Prince Fire 32, he asks if Bobby Bradley hitting the way he is, where do you think he fits with the Indians 26-man roster? To open that second one, I don't think he does. I don't think he's got options. He's still young. I don't think he's going to be on the opening day roster. But if he continues not to strike out, that's obviously his biggest thing. Do you think he makes it? I don't think so, do you? Because I don't think the Indians are smart enough to know that if he doesn't strike out in spring training, that doesn't mean he's fixed. I think they want to see him do it against even consistent AAA pitchers.
Well, I mean, I guess the thing about spring training, too, is everything's so contextual. It's not just the fact that it's only spring training. It's also... Are you facing their ace? Are you facing random pitcher who wears number 68 or whatever?
Yeah.
So I honestly, I mean, I think there's a chance that he could make the opening day roster. Sure. I mean, if he's really doing that well, when you think about it,
Domingo Santana looks really bad so far. So I don't know.
Right. Like who honestly is in front of him in terms of
Jake Bowers?
Yeah, exactly. It's Jake Bowers. It's Domingo Santana. It's,
I mean, this is assuming Franmil in the outfield, which I think is fair at this point.
Right, exactly. I mean, Reyes is definitely going to make it. So outside of that, it's just there's not a lot standing in Bradley's way, right? So if – because what, he has like a 1,400 OPS this year. Yeah, he's beating the hell out of the ball. Jesus Christ.
Oh, Bradley, yeah. Oh, yeah, and they're big home runs too. It's not like
– Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if this – it's so hard with spring training because you're like, it's all freak. But I mean, how many walks does he have? He has one walk, two walks now with one today. He struck out just once, and he's hit a couple of just missiles. But no, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a chance if this keeps up all spring. What the hell else? What else are you looking for? You know, if he just makes more contact, even if he doesn't walk more, then he's still a threat because he can just hit the ball a quarter mile. So
yeah, I think above all, it's the strikeouts are the issues. I just don't know if he can prove enough in spring training to do it, but who knows?
Right, because he's not facing, you know, like you said, he's not facing elite all the time. Like, the average, I know there's somewhere you can find it, the average, like, talent level they're facing during spring training.
Yeah, I think that's an MLB.com leaderboard.
Which okay, yeah.
Usually don't have the best ones, but they do for that. It's really neat. You can see, like I said, the average, I think it goes by level of who they're facing.
Okay, yeah, so.
Yeah, so I'll probably look into that later just to see for fun, but yeah, I don't know. Maybe. It'd be nice because he's fun.
Again, he's hitting the ball a quarter mile and when he runs into one, and if he can run into more, then great.
It's always good. All right, Merritt, that's going to do it for this week. Let's think. We're 2 weeks away from opening day, so we're getting there. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, a month, I don't know.
We are totally not. It's March 1st. No way.
So that's like 3 weeks.
Is it really? Holy
yeah,
shit,
yeah, March 26th, man. We're close. So well, next week we'll preview the, what are we at, shortstop or the, why can't I not remember these when I'm trying to do that?
Stud
sweeper. We got a preview of the sweeper. So yeah, we'll do that next week and talk to you then, Merritt.